All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies, our weekly journey into the soul of the Torah portion. Today, we focus not on the Torah portion, but rather, I know, right? How awkward. Torah Studies without studying the Torah. Well, it's all Torah. We're going to actually talk about the ninth of Av, which is the day of sadness on the Jewish calendar. So in general, we try not to be too sad. I see you have tissues ready. I know it's going to be a tremendously. It is tragic. We'll talk about that. Tisha B'Av is a pretty sad day. So this is known as the saddest day in the Jewish calendar. Typically, we try not to be sad and despondent because we like to be joyous. But there is a day, the ninth of Av, in which we're meant to be a little bit sad.
A time to weep.
Time, exactly. As King Solomon said, you got to have a time for everything under the sun. Awesome.
But you're not allowed to fast this year, right?
This year, the ninth of Av, we don't fast. The ninth of Av is Shabbat. So we push it off a day to the 10th of the 10th of Av, of Menachem Av, which we'll talk about. Sorry?
You don't get a pass.
You know, and right, because you're thinking like, if we push it off once, you know, who's going to know? Let's just keep it. But, you know, that's actually a statement that we say. Once it's been pushed off, hopefully Mashiach will come and it should get pushed off forever and we shouldn't have to fast. But let's talk about what Tisha B'Av is and why we mourn. Why is it marked as a day of sadness? Why?
The destruction
of the Jews. So let's talk about it historically. Does everyone have a copy of the class? Is that the baby?
Yes.
Nice.
Oh,
Amy the baby. Oh, I didn't see that one. You see that? See that? How could you cry with it? How can you cry with a new baby? Sorry?
Babies trump everything.
That's it. That's the way it works. We're going to fight. Bris is Sunday. Okay, so let's talk about what happened on Tisha B'Av. What happened on the ninth day of Av anyway?
The destruction of the Beit HaMikdash
both. The destruction of the two temples. But before that in history, I've compiled a list here on my phone of the things that happened. There's several things that happened on the ninth day of Av. I'm going to start in historical order. Okay, number one. You ready for this? Number one. Remember the spies? Yes. Yes, the spies. They came back with a negative report about the land of Israel and, oh, very cute. It's a baby. Okay. Literally a baby.
We should keep having more.
Yes, more babies. More babies for everyone. So, first of all, the spies came back with a negative report about the land of Israel, and everyone, the entire nation, was crying and mourning. Oh, God wants to kill us, and he hates us. He's taking us to the land of Israel to be slaughtered by the giants in the fortified cities, etc. And so God says, you're crying about nothing. I'll give you a reason to cry. This will be a day of sadness. So the first thing, first tragedy that happens is, in a sense, man-made, the sin of the spies, 1311 BCE. 1311. So it's a good 3,300 years ago.
Is that in here?
No.
It's hard to think of
it. Yeah, but it's not maybe as dramatic as I said it. It's more of like, this will be a day forever marked in infamy because of this choice that's being made. Fast forward 750 years, 800 years, you have the destruction of the first holy temple in Jerusalem by the Babylonians. Babylonians destroy the first temple in and around the year 587 BCE, before the Common Era. In the year 69 of the Common Era, so you have the destruction of the second temple by the Romans. Both temples are destroyed on the same Hebrew date, the ninth day of Av. So the sin of the spies, ninth of Av. Destruction of the first temple by the Babylonians, ninth of Av. Second temple by the Romans, ninth of Av. Let's keep on going. Fast forward.
Excuse me, what was that, the date of the sin of the, I mean, the year of the sin of the spies?
I have here 1311 BCE. Okay, now, there was after the destruction of the second temple, there was a period of calm, and then a period of Jewish revolt to try to gain back the land of Israel and perhaps even build a third temple, led by Bar Kokhba, supported by Rabbi Akiva and others. And of course, that revolt, Bar Kokhba's revolt, we know historically was crushed. The last holdout was Beitar, the fortress of Beitar. That was likewise quelled and pushed down. And that happened, the fall of Beitar happened, the fortress of Beitar happened in 135 of the Common Era. 135 of the Common Era. That also happened on the 9th of Av. The expulsion of Jews from England that lasted for several centuries. Who was it? King George, I want to say? One of the kings.
George
one of the kings.
Was, I think during the Revolution.
George III. It might have been an earlier edition of George. Yeah. So many Georges, yeah. So the Jews were expelled from England on July 18, 1290. July 18. Oh, by the way, you know today is July 18. So that's 1290, and now it's 2018. I don't know. Do the math. It's the anniversary, you know, several hundred years ago. That happened again. The Hebrew date on that was the 9th of Av. Spanish expulsion. 1492, the deadline was July 31st, 1492. That's when they had to get out by. It was signed months earlier, and they said, this is the end date when all Jews need to be out of Spain. The date was July 31st, 1492. Guess what day that corresponded to on the Jewish calendar? The 9th of Av. And World War I, one of the significant moments in 1914 at the onset of the war, when Germany declared war on Russia. That was, the date on that was August 1st, 1914. You guessed it, it was the 9th of Av. And of course, many see the Second World War as a continuation of the First, especially Germany with its campaign due to its losses in the First World War, etc. So one can very well draw the conclusion that the First World War, which led to the Second, which includes the Holocaust, begins also, one of the significant dates happens on the 9th of Av. So clearly it's a day marked in infamy, and a day that is just sadness and tragedy and suffering and pain and loss and displacement flows through the veins of this very day. Again, this year, the 9th of Av is Shabbat. On Shabbat, we don't mourn. We don't show any signs of sadness. So we push off the fast day to the next day, the 10th of Av, which, by the way, the Talmud says is fine and appropriate. Because historically, when the second temple was destroyed, the first temple was destroyed, so they began its destruction a few days earlier, and they began burning it on the 9th of Av, but most of the burning happened on the 10th. In fact, there's an opinion in the Talmud that says that it shouldn't be the 9th of Av that is the fast day. It should really be the 10th of Av, because that's when the major destruction of the temple, or that's when it finally came down all the way to the ground. The majority opinion says, no, you set the fast day when the fire began. But there is one opinion that says the 10th. So if we have to push it off to the 10th, it's not a day that is insignificant vis-a-vis the temple's destruction. It's a day on which the majority of the temple actually burned to the ground. Let's read some texts about this inside. These are Talmudic texts. Let's begin. This is lesson number 3. Yeah, lesson number 3, from morning to morning. And you can find it on page, what page is it?
46.
Page 46, text number 1. Ray, please get us started.
And in the 5th month of Av, on the 10th of the month, that was the 19th year of the rule of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the chief executioner, came and stood before the king of Babylon in Jerusalem.
Okay, so that's a verse from Jeremiah, who talks about the destruction of the first temple, and he says it was the 5th month, i.e. from the month of Nisan. So it's the month of Av, this month, 10th day of the month, not the 9th, 10th day of the month. So the chief executioner, Nebuzaradan, he came and stood before the king of Babylon, i.e. indicating that he came before him and said, the temple is gone. We've destroyed it. We've taken care of it, taken care of business. So again, that's the indication that it finished, destruction concluded on the 10th. It started earlier, and this is something that the Talmud specifies. Text number 2. Karen, please read text number 2. And that has the Talmudic analysis of exactly how the dates worked with the destruction of the temple.
The verse starts, and in the fifth month of, on the seventh day of the month, being the 19th year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came Nebuzaradan, the chief executioner, servant of the king of Babylon, to Jerusalem, and he burnt the house of God. Another verse states, and in the fifth month of Av, on the 10th of the month, that was the 19th year of the rule of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Nebuzaradan, the chief executioner, came and stood before the king of Babylon in Jerusalem.
So two long verses. One comes from Kings and one comes from Jeremiah. The difference is one says that it was the seventh day of the month, and one says it's the 10th day of the month. So was the temple destroyed on the seventh day or the 10th day? So the Talmud explains. In other words, we have here almost a rabbinic dispute, although Rabbi Yochanan didn't live in that generation when they originally set it as a day of fasting and mourning and sadness. But he says, had I been there, I would have voted to mark it on the day that it actually burned to the ground when it concluded, which is the 10th of the month. But the sages of that time, the majority of the sages felt then, and even in his times also felt, that you mark it by the beginning when it starts burning.
Because
once it started, I mean, that was the beginning of the end. You have to wait to see how the whole thing burns down. I mean, it's happening. This is it. That was the day that the temple was essentially destroyed, and that's the way it stands. So again, if it has to be pushed to the 10th because it's the 9th of Shabbat, again, it's all part of the same destruction in the morning. But we're going to ask another question. And the question that we're going to ask, and this is going to drive the entire lesson tonight, the question is, how many years ago did this happen? Thousands of years ago. 2,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, depending which temple, right? Why are we still mourning its loss? We're still fasting. We're still sitting on the floor. We're still not wearing leather shoes.
You could say that about
70 years. All right, hold that thought. It's a good, I like that. 70 years is still relatively short. We're talking about something that's millennia ago, thousands of years ago. And so the question is, yeah, there are a lot of good answers. We're going to have three different perspectives on it. I would say the answers are better than the question. But the question that's going to lead to our discussion is, the question is, why are we still mourning? What are we still mourning? Running a temple.
There hasn't been the third temple.
Okay. But it's still. The question could be asked: how can our hearts still grieve, still mourn, still be sad over something that happened so long ago that you and I have never seen? Right? To feel sad over something that you know, something that you've seen, a loss that you've experienced makes sense. To feel sad over something that you never saw, that your parents never saw, your grandparents never saw, your grandparents, 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 grandparents never saw.
It makes it sadder.
On the one hand, yeah. Okay, Good. So that's the question. Again, there are many different ways to answer the question. And really, this question is meant not as a question that jars us and that shocks us and that stuns us, but it's more of an opening for a broader discussion about what Tisha B'Av means to us today. What does the ninth of Av mean for us today? So let's begin. The first approach that we're going to take is based on an analysis of how the practices, the morning practices of Tisha B'Av, parallel the morning practices that we have following the loss of a loved one. So we know that Jewish law deals extensively with the laws of mourning, what to do when a loved one passes away. So someone who's a relative, a close relative who passes away, so Jewish law talks about the first day, the day of the passing, the day of the burial. Sometimes it's the same day, sometimes it's not. The first 3 days, the first 7 days, the first 30 days, the first 11 months, the first 12 months, the anniversary, etc. There are many, many laws. So many laws, I have in my hand just one of the many volumes of books that have been published on this topic. This is the Jewish Mourner's Companion. All sorts of information about loss and mourning. And what we find something very interesting is that Tisha B'Av, the laws of mourning that we adhere to on the ninth day of Av, were actually formulated to mirror the laws of mourning that exist in Jewish law for an individual mourning the loss of a loved one. So it's a parallel type of mourning, this collective sense of loss over the temple and the personal loss over the loss of a loved one. They kind of mirror each other. Now let's look at this inside the text. Text 4a. Mike, please read this.
The sages taught, all the commandments we follow for mourning, we also follow on the ninth of Av. It is forbidden to bathe, to anoint oneself, to wear leather shoes, or to engage in intimacy. It is also forbidden to read from the Torah, the prophets, or the writings, or to study the Mishnah, the Talmud, or the Midrash, whether legal Midrash or narrative Midrash.
Okay, so you see that? So the Talmud says in Tractate Tainit that the prohibitions that we put in place for mourning, we do the same for the ninth of Av. Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, follows the pattern set by standard laws of mourning. Okay. The Talmud, so on that note, let me read to you some of the laws of Shiva, the first 7 days. Here's some of the laws of Shiva. During Shiva, the mourner is prohibited from sitting on regular chairs, stools, recliners, or couches. We have the same thing on Tisha B'Av. We don't sit on a regular chair. We sit on a lower stool, milk crate, floor, beanbag, whatever it is. Kids' chair, we sit in a lower type of sitting situation. During Shiva, the mourner should not work. Bathe for pleasure, use cosmetics, lotions, oils, perfumes, wear leather shoes, engage in intimacy, study Torah, accept parts dealing with mourning and repentance, greeting people in the usual manner, hello, hi, etc., wearing fresh clothing, taking a haircut, shaving, playing or listening to music, and participating in joyful activities. These are all things that mourners in Shiva do not do. And these are all things that we don't do on the ninth of Av either. So the laws of the ninth of Av parallel the laws of mourning. However, the Talmud says, text 4b, that there is one distinction between Tisha B'Av and the laws of a mourner. Please continue.
However, one may read parts of the Tanakh one is unaccustomed to reading, and to study parts of the oral law one is not used to studying. One may read from the books of Lamentations and from Job, and from the said parts of Jeremiah. Even schoolchildren do not study on Tisha B'Av, since the verse says, the commands of God are right and bring rejoicing to the heart.
Let's focus on that last sentence first and then go into the exception. In general, it says, Pikudei Hashem Yesharim Mesam Chelev. The commandments of God are right and bring rejoicing to the heart. It doesn't only mean the mitzvot, it also means the Torah. The Torah brings joy. Torah study makes one happy. The Talmud also says that if you're not feeling well, if you have a headache or whatever it is, the Torah also can bring personal healing as well. Good health comes through Torah. Joy can come through Torah as well. Yet, the Talmud says, there's an exception. Since Torah brings joy, that's why we don't study Torah in a state of sadness. Are you with me? That's why a mourner in Shiva is not supposed to study Torah. Why not? Why not study God's law? Because Torah brings joy. And the idea is not to engage in joyous activities. You see the premise here. The premise is, Pekudei Hashem Yisharim, Mesam Chelev. Torah brings joy. So Torah brings joy. How can you engage in a joyous activity? You don't go to a concert. You don't go to a comedy show in the middle of Shiva. So you don't study Torah either. Torah brings joy.
There's a minyan during Shiva.
So you only study the parts of Torah. The parts of Torah that deal with the laws of mourning or with things that bring a person to a place of teshuvah, repentance, etc. And one could say that studying a Mishnah in the merit, in the honor, in the Shiva house, in the honor of the deceased, is a part of remembering that person, remembering the loss, and honoring the soul, and it's not about a joyous experience. But studying Torah in general brings joy, and we're not supposed to do that. And likewise on Tisha B'Av, we also don't study Torah. And yet, there's more of an allowance on Tisha B'Av. It says on Tisha B'Av, the Talmud says, text 4b at the first half of the text, you can study parts of Tanakh, that's Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim, the three major parts of the written Torah, you can read parts of Tanakh that you're not used to, and you can study parts of the oral law that you're not used to either. Why? Because those won't bring joy, because you won't understand them. Right? The idea is that if you haven't studied them yet, the stuff that you've studied, you know, you've enjoyed, you're going to enjoy again. Stuff that you're breaking your teeth on for the first time, it's not such a joyous experience. It's not pure pleasure. There's a little work involved. So on Tisha B'Av, the Talmud says, you can study some new stuff. Take a look at text number 5. This is the Tosfot, commentary on Tractate Moed Katan, another relevant point. Sarah, please read.
It is forbidden for a mourner to read from the Torah. In the responsa of Rabbi Yitzchak, my grandfather, he wrote that Rabbi Yaakov, also known as Rabbeinu Tam, forbade to a mourner even the books of Job, Lamentations of Isaiah, or Jeremiah. He forbade them because they were not taught in this section of the Talmud dealing with mourners, as they were in Tractate Hamas about Tisha.
So let me explain that. Tosfot says that when the Talmud in Tractate Moed Katan talks about the prohibition of mourners studying Torah, it does not give the exception about the book of Job, Lamentations, Jeremiah, or new stuff, I'm adding that on, or new parts of Torah. It doesn't give those exceptions. Whereas when it comes to Tisha B'Av, the Talmud opens it up a little bit more. And here's the point. The point is like this. Although Tisha B'Av follows the model of mourning that we adhere to when it comes to personal loss, there are some distinctions. And those distinctions reveal to us that the sadness of Tisha B'Av is a little bit less than the sadness that we experience with a personal loss. When it comes to a personal loss, we're stricter about the Torah that we're not allowed to study. There's less opening to study Torah. Whereas when it comes to Tisha B'Av, there's more allowance to study more pieces of Torah, which indicates that Tisha B'Av, the mourning of Tisha B'Av is a little bit lighter and less than the mourning of a personal loss. Now, let's look at another distinction when it comes to wearing tefillin. So when a person experiences the loss of a loved one, a close relative, so the first day of the passing, a person is in a very deep state of mourning, and Jewish law says that a mourner does not wear tefillin on that day. A mourner, someone who's mourning, would not wrap tefillin and do that mitzvah on that day, the first day of the loss of a loved one. Chabad custom actually is to wear the tefillin, to put them on without a blessing. You don't say a blessing over it, but at least to put them on. But many don't have a custom not to put them on, at all. When it comes to Tisha B'Av, we also don't put on tefillin in the morning. M-O-R-N-I-G. N-G. Right? In the morning of Tisha B'Av, we don't wear tefillin. But in the afternoon service of Tisha B'Av, the mincha service of Tisha B'Av, we do put on tefillin. Again, we see a distinction. Tefillin is like a royal, it's like a crown and like a royal garb. So tefillin evokes happiness and joy. So we don't wear tefillin in a state of personal mourning, but we do wear tefillin on Tisha B'Av with a bracha, with a blessing, a little bit later on in the day. So again, we see that although similar, the mourning, the sadness of Tisha B'Av is a little bit less, a drop less. Take a look at text number 6. This spells this out pretty clearly. Steve, please read this one.
It is logical to assume we are obligated to don the tefillin on Tisha B'Av, since the ban on wearing them applies even to mourners only on the first day, and Tisha B'Av is certainly more lenient than the 7 days of mourning.
So here we have the Rosh, a great halakha codifier, who says that Tisha B'Av, although it's a sad day and a day of mourning, certainly more lenient than Shiva, than the 7 days of mourning. So again, what we find here is that it's a little bit less severe. Why is it less severe? Maybe it should be exactly identical to the way we mark the loss of a loved one. Text number 7, here the Talmud sets the law, sets the theme down, and this is going to be relevant to our discussion. Adina Manka. That's how Rashi explains this piece of the Talmud. And this is the key to understanding really our question, and the first answer to the question that we asked before. Again, Rav Ashi says in the Talmud that new mourning, a sadness, a new fresh sadness of a loss is deeper and stronger and more powerfully felt than old communal mourning. What is the old communal mourning? Tisha B'Av. It's a collective loss, loss of the temple, but it goes back. Well, the Talmud was written 1600 years ago, so it wasn't that old, but it was still older than would be a recent loss. For us, certainly, Tisha B'Av is an older story, whereas losses that we unfortunately experience, that's something that is much more current. So what we see here clearly throughout the laws of Tisha B'Av, the laws of mourning, and the Talmudic discussion about both of them, is that although Tisha B'Av is a very sad day, it's a little bit more lenient than the laws of personal mourning. And the reason, the Talmud says, is because it's an older story. So we asked the question before, why are we still mourning? It happened so long ago. The first answer is, okay, we're mourning, but not as strongly as maybe we would have if it was more recent. You with me? In other words, the question is, why are we still mourning? The answer is, we're mourning, but not as strongly as you know, we've lessened it a drop because it's so old. The question is, it's so old, why are we still doing it? The answer is, all right, so we're going to make it a little bit easier. Make it a little bit lighter. We still put on tefillin. We can study more Torah. We're lessening it up because it's so old. Does that answer the question?
No.
Why not?
Because we're still expecting it.
Because we're still mourning it. In other words, we're still expecting it also, but we're still mourning. So if the premise of the question is, why are we mourning? Right? Why are we mourning at all if it happened so long ago? This doesn't answer. This says we're lessening it up a bit. But this is not fully explaining why we're still doing most of the mourning. Yeah. Certain period of time.
Months,
yes.
So,
that's a great point.
Like,
yeah. And can I enhance your point? That's a really great point. And even on a yard site, we don't have the same restrictions that we do on Shiva. It's not like it's a reenactment of Shiva.
Yeah.
You can't greet people. You have to sit on the floor. We don't do that.
Yeah.
And yet on the anniversary of Tisha B'Av, which let's say is the yard site, right? This anniversary of Tisha B'Av, we do fall back in such a deep state of mourning. And so we haven't really answered the question. Again, the premise of the question is, it happened so long ago, it was very tragic, it was very sad, we get that, but why are we still doing the whole thing, all of the mourning, so many thousands of years later? The attempted answer is, well, we've lessened it up. We've made it a little less severe, but it's still pretty heavy.
Are those destructions, the repeated historical destructions, is it a judgment against us that we're...
I don't know. I don't want to justify any tragedy. I don't want to be a... God doesn't need me to defend tragedy and suffering and pain.
I prefer to, yeah.
Baseless hatred, yeah. Yeah, the Talmud says that. So that we know, but I don't feel comfortable speculating that it's because... I prefer to take the approach of I don't understand why these tragedies happen, and you and I can challenge God and say, hey, or not, maybe not hey, but you and I can challenge... What's up? No, you and I can challenge God and say... You know, fix this. This is not... your children are suffering. We've been in pain. We've experienced all this tragedy, collectively and personally. And so bring an end to this. So that's, I think, the approach, yeah.
These are terrible losses for us personally still. The loss of the temples.
Right. You're saying it's still a present thing. It didn't go away. I'm with you. But yeah, we don't find, like Karen said, we don't find that when it comes to personal loss. I mean, the personal loss... that never gets filled either. I mean, that's a loss that remains forever. That person is not. I mean, that person is not brought back.
It's the loss of the presence of the holy temple of God.
You're right.
The holy presence of God.
Yeah.
The temple.
I mean, the Shekhinah, according to Jewish law, the divine presence is still there on some level. But I mean, the temple itself, and the service, and the high priest, and the altar, and all of that stuff. Yeah, that's certainly no longer there. Listen, I'm not trying to minimize it, and it's more of an opening to explore some themes than an ironclad question. But one approach is to say, because of the age, because of how distant it is, so we've minimized it a drop. But it's still pretty severe. So we have to find something else. So let's continue on the narrative to find another angle of why the sadness, why the mourning. In other words, in addition to the plain explanation, which is that we're mourning the loss of the temple, and that's a pretty big deal, we're looking to find something else to allow this to resonate with us, this type of mourning and sadness. What exactly are we sad about, and what's the objective? So what we're going to do now is turn to a very confounding verse in Mishlei, in Proverbs, written by none other than King Solomon. And you read the verse, and it's very difficult to understand. Text 8a. Text 8a. Who just read?
I did.
You did. Okay. So Dan, please read this one.
In all suffering, there is benefit. But the talk...
Let's leave the second half of the second half of that verse aside for a moment. The first half, Bechol Etzev Yihyeh Mosar. In all suffering, there is benefit. Wow. King Solomon writes, there's an upside to suffering. Gewalt.
Rabbi Weinberg from South Africa, was that his name?
Yeah.
He said, so what are you going to bring out of that that's positive?
Right. Right. Echoing kind of this idea. In all suffering, there is benefit. Take a look at text 8b. So this is how the Alter Rebbe explains it in Tanya. Dan, please read this one as well.
The verse states, quote, in all sadness, there would be profit. The implication is that sadness has no inherent connection, rather that some profit is drawn from experience.
Thank you. This is a very very cryptic text. And I want to explain it using a sports analogy. I love me some sports analogies. So here we go. Imagine you are the kicker on a football team. You know what the kicker does? Right? The place kicker? Right? Yeah, right. So you kick off, but you can score points for your team by kicking the football between the goalposts, 3 points, 1 point, whatever it is, depending on the context. Okay, you get a field goal, 3 points. So imagine you're the kicker. It's at the end of the game, 2 seconds left, timeout on the field, and you're standing there. You're the kicker, and all you need to do is put that ball, kick that ball between the uprights. 3 points, your team wins. It's a tie game. All you need to do is kick that, and it's a short kick. It's an easy kick. You get up there, and you miss it. You totally shank it. You pull it, you hit it, right? You pull it, you push it, whatever it is, wide right, wide left. This has happened before, right? This has happened before. I remember stories. Does Atlanta have a story? I know Buffalo has a story. Real huge football fans everywhere around here. Okay, here's the point. You're the kicker, and you just missed the kick that you've been kicking, you know, in your dreams. Let's say it's the Super Bowl, right? Let's up the ante. It's the Super Bowl. You've been yearning for this moment all your life. When you were kicking in your backyard, breaking neighbors' windows, when you were doing that at a young age, you were 7 years old, you were imagining the game was tied, 3 seconds left, and there you were winning it for your team. That was your dream. That was every kick was that as you were training and practicing. It was all meant for this moment. And now you had it, and you choked. You missed it. How do you feel? You feel terrible. Devastated. You let yourself down, your parents down, your coach is down, your teammates down. The city, the whole city, the hopes and dreams of your city are riding on your shoulders and you missed it. Here's the good news. Did you lose the game? Did you lose the game yet? Remember the scenario? No, the seconds ticked off the scoreboard and it's done now. But it's a tie game. And what happens in a tie game?
Overtime.
So it's not over yet. So what happens is now your team marches down the field again. You win whatever it is. Maybe it's different rules now. So the one team got it, and then they didn't score. Then you got it, and now your quarterback marched down the field and then stopped. 20-yard line. And another timeout, and now it's you again. And now you can win it. All you need to do is make this one kick. This is your chance of redemption. What is the one thing you don't want to think about?
The
last time. Yeah, well, right. What's the one thing that you should not be thinking about?
Hold on, for someone else to kick.
What?
What you just did.
For someone else to
kick. Right now.
What you just did.
What you just did. Your past failure, your very recently past failure, cannot be front and center. If you are thinking about, I missed it last time. If you're panicking over the fact that you just missed it, if you're still depressed and sad and brokenhearted over your miss, over your failure, if you look at yourself or think of yourself as a failure, you know what's going to happen? Likely, you may fail again. You know what the best advice is? What would you tell someone in that situation? If you were their coach, what would you say?
Visualize success.
What else?
This is a fresh start.
What else? All right, by the way. You can do it. What else?
You will do it.
What else? You know what I would say? It's probably the worst thing to say, but whatever. Don't think about the last time, right? Think about it later, right? You're still mentioning it, right? It's terrible. No, but really, the one thing, maybe you don't say it to the guy, but what you definitely don't want this kicker to do is think about the missed kick. But isn't there value in reflecting on failure? Yeah, after the game. After the game, when you win the Super Bowl, in a week, after you've partied, go to the film room, break down the film, and analyze. How are you standing? How was your head? How was your leg? How was the snap? How was the hold? How was your arm? How was your step? How was your follow through? Analyze the wind speed and the angle and the trajectory and analyze all of that from today to tomorrow, but not right now. The Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, the same thing is true with personal success and personal shortcoming. I don't want to say failure, shortcoming. every human being at some point fails. We miss a kick. We miss a kick. Wide right, wide left. We miss the kick. It was right there for us, and we miss it. We miss the opportunity. We didn't do something that we could have done, or we did something that we shouldn't have done, whatever it is. Human beings, inherently flawed, miss stuff. So what happens? What happens now? So a person might think, well, if I am sensitive and self-aware and virtuous and honest with myself, I will be analyzing and replaying the failure over and over in my head to learn from it. What does the author say about that? Not a good idea. Not a good idea to do that in the middle of the day. You want to break down the film at night? You want to break down the film next week? Set a time to break down the film and analyze what you did and how you're going to fix it? That's great. But in the middle of the day, to think about what you did wrong and to let it get you down so that you think of yourself as a failure, so that you'll miss the next kick, because there's another kick coming up. There's another opportunity to do a mitzvah. There's another opportunity to do something more noble. And conversely, the opportunity to fail once again at any given moment throughout the day. There's another kick that's happening right now if you're reflecting and focusing and obsessing on the missed kick. You're going to miss it again. So push it away. That's point number one. Point number two. What happens if you miss the kick and you didn't get a second chance and you lost the game? You lost the game. And the articles come out and they say that you, the kicker, you messed up.
Disappointed everyone.
Really laying it heavy on, right? Okay. So you feel terrible about this.
Clutched.
Yeah. There's two ways to respond. Number one. One approach is to say, I messed up. I'm terrible. I'm a good for nothing. I let everyone down. And you become broken by that experience. So broken that you can't pick yourself back up. In other words, you become sad and depressed and despondent from that failure, and you become so low that it's hard to get back up. That's one approach. Another approach is to cut out every single article that talked about how terrible you were, and you put it on your locker, inside your locker, and you use it as
fuel,
inspiration, motivation to kick another 1,000 practice kicks a day.
I don't like that.
Which one? The second one?
Putting all those negative articles.
No. What I'm saying is, in a positive way, you know, they say about Michael Jordan that after one of his early years, maybe even after his rookie year, the report came out, he's great on offense, but on defense, terrible. You know what he did? He became the best defender in basketball. He worked hard, and he said, I'll show all of the critics, I'll show all of them. And he became the defender of the year multiple years running after that. In other words, he used the negative press. It didn't get him down and break him. He used it as a fuel to fire him to get even better. So the Andre Rebbe says like this, that when a person reflects on personal failure, it could either be a depressing experience or a motivating experience. In the language of Tanya, in the language of Chassidus, there are two emotional reactions. One is called atzfus, which is depression, sadness, depression, gets you down. And one is called merirus. Merirus means, it's literally translated mar, like marar. What's marar?
Bitter.
So it's bitterness. But it's not bitter like I'm bitter about this thing that happened. No, it's a self reflected bitterness, but it's not sadness and despondency. It's like an edge that gets you going to get greater and better than before. It's hard. The bitterness in English doesn't work. In the Hebrew, It's a little bit more elegant, the merirus, that Hebrew phrase, but in contradistinction to atzvus, which is about a self-induced sadness and depression where the negativity gets you down and you can't get up. You're stuck. You can't get out of that space. Merirus is an activating agent that gets you stronger and better than before. So now we can understand, in a sense, why we focus on mourning the temple's destruction on Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av. Why? It's meant to be a catalyst to accomplish something better. Reflect on past failure. Reflect on what we've done wrong collectively as a nation, etc. Reflect on the mistakes we made. Reflect on tragedy in order to bring out a greater positivity, a greater good. Let's read this inside. There's a beautiful text here. I actually want to start with text 14, which is, I believe, a letter from the Rebbe. And then we're going to go back to Tisha B'Av. So text 14, who's got this one? Anne, please read text 14.
Neglect and laziness or feelings of hopelessness, then this is an indication that they come from the evil inclination, which has hid and donned garments of piety. For all of the above hinder the individual in his divine service.
So a person is feeling bad over the past. So the Rebbe says it's very simple. And you're not sure, like, is it a good feeling? Is it not a good feeling? The Rebbe says, look, in a letter, this is a personal letter he wrote to somebody. I don't know what the question was, but this is his response. So the Rebbe writes, ask yourself the following question. When you have these feelings, what is the outcome? Are you more motivated to do something good or less motivated? If you're more motivated, go for it. Feel these negative thoughts and be more motivated. Use this bitterness as a catalyst for greatness, for positivity, for another mitzvah. But if you're finding that these negative thoughts are keeping you down or schlepping you down, getting you stuck in a negative space, then this is not a negative. This is not a positive feeling. It's not coming from the Yetzer Tov, from the Nefesh Elokis. It's not coming from the good part of ourselves. It's coming from the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination in the animal soul. It's coming. It's the evil inclination wearing the garments of a tzaddik, righteous garments, and the evil inclination now looks like the good inclination. You can't even tell the difference. The evil inclination says, let's feel bad about our sins. That sounds good, right? Nope, not necessarily. If you're the kicker and your feeling of remorse over the past is going to keep you down, if you're, you know, alhamdulillah, Michael Jordan, and your feelings of critique, of you not being a good defensive player is going to get you down, and now you're going to also not be good on offense, and it's going to end your career based on this criticism, then it's not a good thing to reflect on. But if you have the strength to utilize it as a catalyst for growth, then indeed you should focus on it, and it's coming from a good place. Let's bring it back to Tisha B'Av and text. Okay, I'm going to paraphrase text 10a, 10b, 10c, and then we're going to read text 11 inside together. All right, so David, you're going to read text 11 in just a moment. But first, I need to tell you the following. The Talmud says about 2 months, that when these months come in, we're supposed to adjust our happiness quotient. So it says when Adar comes in, Mishenichnas Adar, when Adar comes in, it's the month in which we have the holiday of Purim. So it says Mishenichnas Adar, Marbim Besimcha. We increase in joy. When Adar comes in, increase in joy. Mishenichnas Av, when Av comes in, when Av, Menach, this month, the month of Av comes in, Mimaitin besimcha, you decrease in your joy. So when Adar comes in, increase joy. When Av comes in, decrease joy. Make sense? Great. The Munkacher Rebbe in text 11 asks the following question. When it comes to Adar and increasing joy, the Talmud does not tell us what to do. It doesn't say, throw a dance party, invite your friends, make a barbecue, do a potluck, hold a raffle. I don't know what else is... play shuffleboard.
Bocce ball,
right? None of that. It doesn't tell, it doesn't specify what we're supposed to do. It just says be joyous. When it comes to of this month, when we're supposed to decrease in joy, suddenly the Talmud says, do this, do that, don't do this. For the first 9 days, don't get a haircut, don't get married, don't listen to music, don't do this, don't eat meat, don't drink wine, all this stuff. For the first 9 days, it starts telling us a list of things what not to do. Why does it, we don't have a parallel, it's not mirrored. If you're telling me what to do to decrease joy, why aren't you telling me what to do to increase joy? And the Munkacher Rebbe says, the answer is simple. Because when the Talmud says increase in joy, whatever it is, keep on increasing joy. It's not going to only limit you to certain things to do. Do whatever you want to increase joy. Not whatever you want, I mean, as long as it's kosher. But do whatever it is to increase in joy. Whereas when it comes to of and decreasing joy, the Talmud is not giving you carte blanche, openness to do things to make you depressed. It says decrease in joy in these very narrow and specific areas. The objective is not to get all the way down. The objective is to get a little bit down, as we know now, in order to get up. Sometimes, as King Solomon writes, you need some negative to get positive. There's a benefit with a sadness. So you get a little bit sad to get a little bit up. That's the formula. Not all the way down. You get all the way down, B'chol Atzev Yeh Moser, it says, with sadness there is a benefit. That's when it's a controlled, mindful bitterness, not this low depression that you can't get out of, right? I mean, you could. I'm saying that that's not what we're going for. Text 11, the Munkacher.
When we enter Adar, we increase in joy, but the Talmud does not tell us how we are supposed to increase it. It teaches us to increase joy almost as a tangential remark. But is there not a general principle that the positive is greater than the negative? Why would the Talmud speak less about increasing joy than decreasing it? Rather, to the contrary, this was an intentional omission on the part of the sages. When it comes to decreasing joy, the sages enumerated the specific means to do so, so that we would not mistakenly think we were obligated to be utterly dejected or depressed, God forbid.
You see that? The Talmud has to specify, when I told you to decrease in joy, don't go all the way. Just these things. Continue.
In truth, utter dejection is no path for students of our master, the Baal Shem Tov of blessed memory, and those who follow him. They are obligated to always be brokenhearted in grieving the exile and the destruction of the temple, but never to be completely dejected to the point of despairing of the future redemption. Joy is, in fact, a biblical commandment. Since you did not serve me in joy, therefore it is certainly forbidden to be completely dejected. This is why the sages established only the specific ways in which to decrease joy for the month of Av, in order to exclude all the other manners in which one is permitted to strengthen oneself with joy and trust in God with a full faith, with a heart full of faith, and looking forward to the redemption. By contrast, when one enters Adar, there is no specific way in which to increase joy, because the positive is greater than the negative. There is no limit to this increase in joy, no area of life that is excluded from this mitzvah.
Thank you. So in the bottom line is the Munkacher is teaching us, the Alter Rebbe is teaching us, the Talmud is teaching us that the sadness of this month, the month of Av, and Tisha B'Av, is a constructive sadness. It's a sadness that is indeed sad, but it's meant for a constructive purpose to get us to a better place. So we asked the question at the beginning. We've given two answers. I have one more. We're going to do it very quickly. We asked the question at the beginning of the class, why are we mourning thousands of years later? Answer number one, we're mourning a little less than we could have, had it been closer. Answer number two, So that's answer number one. Answer number two, the sadness that we have is not a destructive sadness, it's a constructive sadness. So if it's a constructive sadness, so it's a good thing. Sometimes you need a little bit of sadness to stir you to greater growth. Sometimes that missed kick, again, lahavdil, right? That missed kick, lahavdil means to like separate, not to, you know, equate the structure of the temple and missing a kick in football, right? It's not the same thing at all. So lahavdil. But sometimes you need the missed kick to really become a better kicker. You need to be told that you're not good at defense to become the greatest, you know, in your time in that role. So sometimes you need to be a little bit down to get a little bit higher. So we're told, think about the negativity, think about the negative stuff, think about the sadness, the destruction, the mourning, in a specific way, in order to have that construct to serve a constructive purpose. The final point, yeah.
So during the course of the day, is that why we
it lessens a little bit? Yes, yes, yes. So the final point. Yes, exactly. In other words, since the aim is a constructive purpose, so that's why it doesn't get worse and worse and worse. It actually gets lightened. We end up, we don't put on tefillin in the morning, but we put on the afternoon. We don't sit on a chair at night or in the morning, but in the afternoon, we can sit on a chair. That's pretty much it. We don't start eating until nightfall, but we do lessen. Oh, we can study Torah after midday. So we start finding the light, because it's meant to discover the light. That's why also when we read the Book of Lamentations, the last two verses are Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha v'nashuva Chadesh Yameinu Kekedem. That's the second to last verse. And the last verse of the book of the book of Eicha, Lamentations, is Ki im ma'ois ma'astani katzafta aleinu ad ma'oid. So let's actually look at it inside. Text 12. Look at text 12 for a second. Text 12 says, return us to you, God, and we will be returned. Renew our days as of old. That is the second to last verse. In other words, it's a verse of hope. And look at the last verse. For you have truly rejected us and bitterly raged against us. Oy! It ends on a very sad note. So what's our custom? Our custom is, at the end of reading the Book of Lamentations, and we end with that last verse, we repeat the second to last verse again. And we end with Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha v'nashuva Chadei Shemeinu Kegedem. We end not with the last verse of the Book of Lamentations. We end with the second to last verse. So again, we read the second to last verse, the last verse, and then we go back and read the second to last verse again. We end on a positive note. We end the day in a hopeful note, on a positive note, because it's all about a constructive sadness. Final point, and this to me is the most powerful. The question is, let's reset the question. Why the sadness? Why the mourning? So long ago, we're still mourning, we're still sad. What's going on with that? There's a parallel in the Bible, in the Torah. There's a parallel in the Torah of somebody who would not stop mourning. Who kept on mourning over a loss? It's Yaakov, Jacob. Our forefather Jacob never stopped mourning a personal loss. The loss of whom? His son, Joseph. 17 years old, and his son is gone. And he believes that what happened was his son was ripped apart by a wild animal. The brothers, his sons, showed him the garments, the multicolored coat of Joseph, stained in blood, ripped apart. And he said, Oy, Tarav, Tarav, Yosef. Yosef, Joseph was surely ripped apart by a wild animal. And he mourned. And the Torah tells us, and our sages tell us, that he mourned for 22 years. And that mourning of 22 years did not decrease over time. You see, when we have the laws of mourning, there's a mourning of the first day, 3 days, 7 days, 30 days, 11 months, 12 months, and it gets at least in the realm of halacha, of Jewish law, the mourning gets less and less and less. When it came to Yaakov, to Jacob, 22 years with the same degree of sadness and mourning and loss felt and experienced as day one. And the commentators ask the question, why? Why? What? The commentaries, the Mefarshim, the commentaries, the Talmud. I don't remember where it's sourced. It's sourced in original Jewish thought. Why the sadness? Why the sustained sadness? And the answer that's given is that God gives us, in a sense, a gift when it comes to loss, that the loss should be alleviated and felt a little bit less. The nature of loss is that over time, it becomes a little easier to bear. Not that it's ever replaced, as I mentioned before, but it becomes a little easier to bear. But when something is not truly lost, the pain is felt as it was on day one. See, that's only a gift, a blessing that God gives when something is actually lost. When someone passes away. Joseph had not died. Joseph was still alive. And so God's blessing of, in a sense, forgetting, not really forgetting, but lessening the intensity, was not given. It's almost like a miraculous blessing that God allows us to cope and move forward with life. But that's when there's an actual loss. When there's no loss, God doesn't grant that special blessing. And so Joseph had not died. Joseph had not died. And since he was not dead, he was not lost. He was missing to his father, but he wasn't lost in the sense of life and death lost. So therefore, Yaakov, his father, was not given the gift of lessening the pain. And so he felt it acutely for 22 years. That probably should have been an indication that his son was still alive. Because had he not been alive, it would have decreased. The fact that it was so intense, perhaps would have indicated, might have, should have indicated, whatever, on some level, that he was still alive. So what does it mean for us? We ask the question, why do we still feel the loss of the temple? Why are we still mourning? You know what the answer is? Because it's still alive for us. If it was truly gone, if it was gone, if it was a footnote in history, there was a time 2,000 years ago when life was good for the Jewish people. We had a temple, rock and rolling. Oh well, we live in a different world today. If that was the attitude, we wouldn't sit here every Tisha B'Av and mourn and fast and deprive ourselves, etc. We wouldn't. We would have forgotten it. We would have moved on. We would have said, you know what? It was a nice time. Things were good then. That life moves on. But the temple is not gone from us, from our hearts and our minds. The temple is still alive. The temple is still a reality. It may not be there physically, but it's a reality that's still alive. In our hearts and our minds, the spiritual temple is still alive. And therefore, because the spiritual temple is still alive, part of us doesn't accept its loss. And because we don't accept its loss, that's what makes it so painful. Because it feels like an impossibility. How could this be lost? It's so integral to our existence. It's so important to who we are as a people. That God should have a home on earth. That's a huge thing. And this is the theme, really, that when I first asked the question, this was a point that was coming up. What do you mean? The temple is so important. That's exactly the final point. The temple is so important that its memory does not die. If at any point its memory died, we wouldn't be mourning. The reason why we still mourn every Tisha B'Av, we still fast 25 hours. Ay, right, why? Why? We don't wear leather shoes. We deprive ourselves of many things. Why? Because the temple is still alive to us. Let's read one final text. Text 17. Rashi, who refused to be comforted, did Jacob. One does not accept consolation for a living person presumed dead. Regarding the dead, God has decreed that they will be forgotten from one's heart. But it has not been so decreed regarding the living. The living remain forever in our memory. Finally, text 19 from the Talmud. We will conclude with this text. The verse states, "Rejoice with Jerusalem and be glad with her, all who love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all who mourn for her." From this we learn, whoever mourns for Jerusalem merits to see her joy. And whoever does not mourn for Jerusalem does not see her joy. What that means is, when you feel the pain of the loss, it means you're living with its presence. That's why it hurts. Because Jerusalem and the temple, is so real to you, its loss is so painful to you. And therefore, you'll merit to see its redemption, its rebuilding. If the temple does not mean anything, God forbid, whatever. We once had a temple. Yeah, we had a lot of things. You know, whatever. I once had a swing set. I mean, like, if that's how we look at it, if that, God forbid, then that means we're not living with it, and the sadness is not so sad. So the point is like this. Not that we should overdo the sadness, and not that we should, you know, become depressed like we mentioned before, but the point is that it should be a day that really strikes us and affects us, that we don't have a temple that is so important to us. And when we hold that dear, it means that paradoxically, in a sense, because we mourn its loss so much, it's not so lost from us. The more we mourn it, in a sense, the more real it is to us, the more alive it is. That's why it's so painful, because it's so alive. And because it's alive to us, we're going to see it again. May this be the year, finally, when we don't have to fast after thousands of years of fasting, that we don't have to fast because we will be united with Mashiach, our righteous Redeemer, and have a third temple in Jerusalem, our holy city, and there will be no more sadness. And as the prophet says, that God will dry the tear off of every single face in the world, and there will only be joy. May it be speedily in our days, and let us say, Amen. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.